The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh.
Hi, my name is Allison Heller. I am one of the co-founders of FentCheck, which is a nonprofit that distributes fentanyl test strips to local venues and small businesses in an effort to lower the overdose rate.
And my name is Dean Schold. I'm the other co-founder of FentCheck. And Ellie gave you a great idea of what we do. We are trying to actually save lives, provide harm reduction to people who don't know they need harm reduction.
How did FentCheck get started?
So I used to volunteer a lot with street-based harm reduction efforts, which is a extreme crisis out here in the Bay Area. I used to volunteer with St. James Infirmary, Punk Swift Lunge, a couple of other really awesome grassroots organizations where we're distributing resources to folks who are, you know, living out here on the streets. And that's where I was introduced to fentanyl test strips, which I think are incredible technology. And I saw a need for them, a vision for them that could be like the condoms from the AIDS crisis that you would see in bar bathrooms. And that's how we've gotten to where we are. We have these free fentanyl test strips, really clear instructions, also with a QR code that goes back to our website that you can find in bathrooms, grab them anonymously. And now you have this resource before you're going to engage with drug use. You can test a sample of what you're about to ingest and know whether or not fentanyl is present. And I think it's really an important right. And we've been really excited to bring that to different cities.
There's a couple of myths about this. And one is that it's only people who are using the illegal street opiates and not people using other drugs that would have to be at risk. The other myth is that the only people who need to be concerned are people who have, you know, substance use disorder they're using frequently in large quantities. You know, they're those no legislators, kids, just trying an experiment on a weekend would ever be at risk. And that's a myth, too. I mean, who is really at risk from fentanyl?
Who we're really looking at is people who are using recreational drugs infrequently, people who are maybe going to a concert and ingesting something or celebrating New Year's, people who are trying drugs recreationally are not going to have the same tolerance for opioids as somebody who is a street-based user. That means when we're looking at fentanyl, which is 50% stronger than heroin, 100 times stronger than morphine, you're more likely to have an overdose if you are a recreational or experimental user. We want to make sure that that kid who is making an impulsive decision to experiment, or that adult who remembers cocaine or pressed pills from their college days as not being this lethal, have the access to your resource that gives them informed consent.
How have venues been responding to this initiative? How are they supportive? How are the venues?
It was pretty hard, you know, introducing this as a concept to a lot of venues. A lot of places were concerned that this was going to maybe, quote unquote, bring in the wrong crowd. But so many venues understood that a lot of times recreational drug use is just a part of nightlife, no matter what kind of venue you run. And once working with us, have seen how patrons are so thankful that they are supplying these and working with the community. They've been really excited to work with us. It went from us knocking on doors and asking venues to collaborate with us to a lot of venues coming to us at this point. Well, I mean, we're so excited to have brought this not only to bars and restaurants, but also to bookstores, tattoo parlors, thrift stores, and now UC Berkeley. We now have these on college campuses.
How's the what's been the response of public officials? You know, the elected, unelected, the those types.
Remarkably bipartisan.
What we always talk about is, you know, cocaine is bipartisan, and we can talk to any party. When we actually worked with the Senate on the Public Safety Committee on the Assembly Bill 1598, which is the one in California that actually took carved out things that test for fentanyl out of drug paraphernalia. What we found is that all of the supporters, everyone supported it. It was, every vote was unanimous. It was completely bipartisan. And there was nobody who, even though you could do public comment, there were all kinds of supporters, no one objected to it. So it's very clear that there is a tremendous following for making sure that this is legal. And I mean, if you look at Oregon, for crying out loud, I can have 2 grams of coke, but I can't test to see if there's fentanyl in it. That is just wrong. And that is something that we're working on trying to solve in Oregon, as we did in California. We were involved with Wisconsin. You know, you've got Philadelphia, where the mayor actually did an executive order allowing this to be legal. So we think that there is a lot of potential to save lives by clarifying that one point that came from a law that was, the model was created in 1979 by the DEA. They were focused on headshots. They were not focused on rainbow fentanyl. This is a law that has outlived its usefulness.
Reducing harm is managing risk. I mean, these, you know, these really shouldn't be controversial notions, but of course, that's where we are. And test strips are illegal in several states, Texas, Georgia, Florida. They're classed as drug paraphernalia. I mean, it's ridiculous. And other states like California are better, smarter, more compassionate. You know, I was hoping that I was going to be able to include Oregon in the latter group. But of course, we are among the former, where, you know, Oregon and Texas have something in common, more stuff in common. I looked at Oregon revised statutes this morning just to get the language. And there it is, defined as drug paraphernalia. And there is a specific exception in Oregon's law to allow syringe service programs to distribute hypodermic syringes and needles. There's actually media reports of a bar here locally, Southeast Portland Star Bar, that was distributing test strips. But I hope the legislature's paying attention. Was there an effort up here last year? Am I right?
There was not an effort to really focus on the legality of test strips, right? When Measure 110 passed, that changed a lot. It decriminalized personal possession of limited quantities of a certain number of controlled substances, including cocaine, including heroin, including meth. That happened. Unfortunately, because that was a citizen-created law that has come through, there were limited opportunities to change it. And the changes that they made were around the funding of the harm reduction programs, the MAT programs that should come out from the savings from this. So the challenge has always been, you can't change every law all at the same time. And this Model Act, which was created in 1979, I believe Oregon adopted a lot of it in the early 80s, that still stays there. Now, when we had reporters from COIN who actually reached out to the DA and reach out to PPB. And PPB has no resources to be able to worry about this. And they understand what is going on. They're also the ones who are involved in some of these huge drug seizures. So while it's common sense, and I mean, Doug, you know this because you've done a lot of these interviews. It's common sense, but it's not common law yet. And we need to fix that. And the fact that when I approach University of Oregon, their concern is, well, we can't do this because it's not legal. And that's a huge issue. And Berkeley, you know, congratulations, UC Berkeley, they actually went out on a limb and they did this. And now we've followed up, as we will in Oregon, hopefully, with making it completely legal.
It seems like a no-brainer. It seems like an easy thing. Well, of course, the overdose, these massive overdose deaths haven't been as much in the news up here until just the last couple of years. I mean, for some reason, we weren't really seeing a lot of that in the media. You know, while it's going on everywhere else in the country, we haven't been being reported on rather heavily. We hadn't been seeing quite as much. And now we have. They have been talking about a lot of that now. So Let's get FenCheck. You're now located in East Bay. You are expanding. Where are you at so far down there? Out in California, and are you working in other states yet?
So I'll let Ellie talk about California, and then I'll talk about some of the expansions.
So we started here in the Bay Area in Oakland around January 2021. And now we are in San Francisco. We're just expanding to LA. We're also in New York City, Philadelphia, Portland, of course. Obviously, I'm going to miss one. I'm really excited about this call I just ended about expanding in Wisconsin, which also just had the legalization of fentanyl test strips, which Dean and I were really excited to be a part of that. And the community is coming to us to go knock on doors and get the same process started.
I mean, in Oregon, and I'll talk a little bit about Portland because that's where I live right now. Although for 3 years I was down in Oakland when we started this because you couldn't travel. Thank you, COVID. And it actually worked out really well. We were able to come up with a template of how to do this and how to expand and how to actually make it work in other cities as well. This notion of crowdsourcing harm reduction. In Portland, for example, Starbar, which you've taught Josh, who is the owner of Starbar, actually reached out to us because he knew somebody who owned one of the venues that we worked with down in Northern California. And, you know, it just permeates. It's like, this is a really good idea. Why don't we do it up here? And he's been very courageous. He's been very open about it. And, you know, as the news broadcasts over the last few weeks have talked about rainbow fentanyl and all the drug seizures, literally within a day of that breaking, their entire stock of test strips was taken because people knew that this was a place they could get fentanyl test strips. So in addition to Star Bar, we have other venues. We've also worked with things like on the Lose Your Mind Festival. We were in the artist hospitality area to make sure that the artists had the ability to check their drugs. We've worked with North Warehouse on some of their music events as well. So we're trying to expand. At the same time, we're trying to fix the legal issues that many people are fixated on. So we're trying to do both at the same time. And that's the challenge and that's the beauty.
Do you end up working with some of the other, there's Dance Safe and there's an effort in the UK called The Loop, which are drug checking services. A lot of them are based at festivals and music events. But there is there's a growing concern about this, you know, in regard to drug checking, it seems.
We're really inspired by Dance Safe. Dance Safe is incredible and paved the way for so many harm reduction organizations like us to do what we do. We really want to carve out this ability for folks to have complete anonymity and the just ability to test where they want to and go. We're really inspired by funding for the AIDS crisis and that, you know, you don't have to interact with us individually to have these services. I think if we can destigmatize drug checking as much as possible, the community will be safer.
What's been the reaction to just people? How have people out of the general public, how's the general public been responding?
What it's really highlighted for me is that there is absolutely no demographic for who is using and engaging with recreational drug use. And that now with fentanyl overdoses being the number one cause of death for Americans ages 18 to 48, it is something that we have all been touched by. There is, you know, it's not who you think is who is engaging with these fentanyl test strips. And it has been an honor to, you know, to have these comments from the community where people are just so thankful for this. We're just really happy to provide and help engage other, you know, cities and their own chapters of FentCheck to provide these for their own communities as well.
We're a 501c3. All of the resources that we have come from venues or come from individuals who are donating to make this happen. If you ask about what the response has been, the fact that we have grown We have grown through the different cities. We continue to grow. That is because people actually care about this. They want it. And they're telling us with their donations that they want it. And they want it in more places, more cities, more venues. So the response has been phenomenal. There hasn't been anyone who has complained about it.
So how can people find out more about FenCheck and support the work that you're doing? The website, obviously, which is social media.
The best way to get engaged with us is through our website, our Instagram, our Facebook, our email, admin at FenCheck.org. And we are always onboarding new volunteers. We're always looking for donations, of course, and also creative ways get those. We're willing to collaborate, get creative with you in funding on any level. We really think this is important everywhere, and we're open for collaboration.
We've got a presence on Instagram at FenCheck, Facebook FenCheck. You can see the pattern here. Fortunately, we picked a name that no one else had, so we get it on all the social media. By the way, Venmo, we're at FenCheck as well, and PayPal.
And it's in the website again is, of course, FenCheck.org.
Yes, sir.
There's another project you're involved with, West Oakland Punks with Lunch. What's that about?
West Oakland Punks with Lunch are an incredible organization and kind of helped me get my feet wet in street-based harm reduction. So they provide resources of all kinds to street-based users here in Oakland and the houseless. They're grassroots, and they definitely encourage anybody who is looking to volunteer on street-based harm reduction to look into them.
Also, tell listeners, if you could, about St. James Infirmary. I'm familiar with them. They do great work. But
St. James Infirmary are incredible innovators they provide harm reduction mostly towards sex workers here in San Francisco, Tenderloin area, but also outwards. They have really consistent with the themes of innovation and compassion for volunteering and serving the community. It's really been an honor to have worked with them and to be inspired by them.
What question have I not asked that I should have?
I think the question that might be worthwhile answering is the magnitude of what we are doing, where we are literally distributing to people who are using them thousands of test strips every week. So if you think of the scope of what we're doing, that is a measure that we look at a lot, and we're looking at the different types of venues and the quantities of test strips that they're going through. And it is phenomenal. We, even with UC Berkeley, they just acquired 4,000 test strips for their students. This is a problem that there is a solution for, and our goal is simply to allow that solution to actually get into the hands of the people who need it.
And that's just down there. That's now multiply that by just even a major American cities, college cities.
We can't wait to get there. We really can't wait. And if you're listening to this and this really resonates with you, we want to hear from you too.
The one thing, if you look at our website, that's really interesting is we have an interactive map where we actually have plotted all of the venues that have these strips available. So anyone who is in San Francisco, in LA, even in Portland, in New York, they have the ability to find out where there are strips available very easily using a customized version of literally Google Maps. So it's the basis for it. So it's something to look at, and it's something that really makes it more available to people who, people don't know where the SSPs are. They don't know where the needle exchanges are. They're cooks in restaurants. They are, again, techies who are getting promotions. It is a different demographic, and we want to, you always hear in harm reduction, we want to meet people where they're at, where the people in our demographic are at. They're at bars, they're at bookstores. they are at the venues that we are trying to make sure have these strips available.
Kids away from kids, young adults.
Kids, all the kids, well, you know.
Young adults on their first trip away, you know, away from home without their parents and exactly. Off to the big city. And
we really want to get to a point where your first time that a kid is, you know, knowledgeable about Narcan and fentanyl and all that isn't their first day on a college campus. It really needs to be part of our class curriculum. It really needs to be part of our culture because this isn't going to solve fentanyl going away. This is just to solve these accidental fentanyl poisonings.
Parents have to have a tough conversation with their kids. They just have to. And parents have to be there to support their children as they experiment, as they get inquisitive. Keep them safe. Don't tell them, don't do it, because we've seen how that works over years.
Just say no.
Which I would find a lot easier than having a condom discussion. The condom conversation is,
absolutely.
I mean, that's cringe.
Listen, we say all the time, anyone who's ever had that conversation with a parent or a teacher about condoms and safety, we're never incentivized to have sex. It's the same with the fentanyl test strips. It's just about preventative health and safety and public health.
And if it's as uncomfortable as any of the condom conversations, it'd probably put them off from ever wanting to use drugs for years.
Bingo. Well, that's what we're, you know, that may not be what we're hoping for, but we just hope for really resonating and important conversations about safety that are realistic. I mean, if we're really looking at realistic expectations for our youth, we know that this is going to happen and we want to make sure they're safe. That's it.
Well, again, folks, we're speaking with Allison Heller and Dean Schold. They're the co-founders of FentCheck. FentCheck.org. So any closing thoughts for our listeners?
Stay safe out there. Carry Narcan and test for fentanyl.
This is something we do for our families. This is something we do for children. It's also publicly the right thing to do. If you look at a $1 test strip that could save somebody from having to use $150, which is the cost of two doses of Narcan, or $6,000 to go to the ED, it's absolutely financially the right thing to do. So if you're thinking about, is this the right thing to do? It's the right thing to do. It's the responsible thing to do. And it's fiscally very responsible for us from a public health perspective. So there's no reason why this shouldn't happen everywhere. And that's what we're trying to do.
That was my conversation with Allison Heller and Dean Schold, co-founders of FentCheck. Find them on the web at FentCheck.org. That's FentCheck.org. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Well, the second part of that interview with Claire Zagorski from the University of Texas Austin that I promised you last week, that's going to have to wait until next week. We have just enough time. I had the chance recently to speak with a really brilliant person, Tara Hurst from the Health Justice Recovery Alliance in Oregon, about a personal thing. So I quit using alcohol entirely about a year ago. It was for my physical health. I had kidney damage from the chemotherapy back in 2003, and I really should have quit back then. But I wasn't going to call this recovery because all I was doing was stopping the use of alcohol because I didn't want to end up dying someday from kidney failure. I'm told it's not a very pleasant way to go. But I have been using alcohol for a very, very long time and at times much too much. So anyway, a few months into it, and all the stuff that I've been avoiding and all the regrets and all the bad decisions, so many bad decisions, and all the stuff that I had been using alcohol to bury and to avoid, I can't turn away from it now. I can't turn away from it anymore. I'm really good at beating myself up over stuff. And the list of stuff, the things that I'm angry with myself about and disappointed in myself over, all the bad choices, the failed marriage, the failed relationships, every other failure. You know, but I'm getting through it. And, you know, I have amends to make. I have a lifetime of things for which I need to atone. And I'm now defining myself as a person in recovery. And I was sure there was a question in my mind when I started this monologue. And while I'm trying to remember what it was, Tara, I want to thank you for helping me sort out my thoughts on all this. I've been thinking about our last interview and the stuff we talked about then, and I wanted to let you know on the record that it has really helped me a lot. It's perspective, you know, it's like the man said, use it or lose it. I've been thinking about my attitude toward myself and toward others, about how easy it is to be judgmental, how easy and how unhelpful it is. And now I've remembered one of the questions I had, and which after this prologue was going to sound a little silly because this is, I mean, what is this? But this is a serious practical question. I'm approaching 1 year since I stopped using alcohol, and I want to know when I should mark my soberversary, as I think it's called. Should that be the day after the last time I used alcohol? In my case, that would be the last day I had, and it was in September 24th, so it would be September 25th. Is that what would be the, what? How do you define it? So what is a soberversary?
So I think it depends on the person. That's an individual choice. For me, my sober anniversary, September 8th, 1996. That was the day I landed in Fort Lauderdale and got picked up to go to a treatment center in Delray Beach, where I spent 12 years of my life. You know, I think everybody, there is no shoulds, or there shouldn't be any shoulds. It's whatever is meaningful to you. And it's your journey. And on the coin, I got sober through the 12 steps and through AA. It says, to thine own self be true. And I take that really to heart, and I take it very literally as well. It's what you can go to bed at night knowing, and what is true for you. And I think, you know, through my recovery journey, what I've learned just from doing the work that I'm doing with Health Justice Recovery Alliance and with some incredible people who do harm reduction and, you know, drug policy work, is that recovery means really different things to different people. And we need to stop deciding which one's better. You don't judge people's, you know, in other illnesses. You mentioned that you had to go through chemo and that you're battling cancer. We don't judge how you went through chemo. We don't judge how somebody decides. Maybe we do a little bit more with diabetes. But, you know, it's about really making sure that we are keeping our own side of the street clean, to thine own self be true, and recognizing that everybody has a different path, everybody has a different journey. And I think when we start stigmatizing and putting shame and thinking we need to punish people into submission to admit that their lives have become unmanageable, is when people die, because there's too much shame to come back. And what we do know is that relapse is a normal thing in addiction and in alcoholism. And yes, it's painful and it's okay to be angry about it, but we need to stop shaming people. And if somebody needs to use one substance to get over another substance and they're happy and healthy, then who am I to judge what their path is, or that their path is any less than mine? So, you know, that's just kind of a long way of saying that we all have our own journeys. We all have our own paths. And I think it's really important that we support each other and root for each other and not try and pick apart why and how we do things.
That was from a conversation with Tara Hurst, the executive director of the Health Justice Recovery Alliance in Oregon. Find them on the web at healthjusticerecovery.org. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war
on drugs.
For the
Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.